Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly legislative podcast. I'm John Pimble.
I wrote down a couple things here so I don't break into one of my marginally useful stories, and we'll stay on task here.
Craig Paulson was the Speaker of the House from 2011 through 2015. He is back at the Capitol in front of the Senate Ways and Means Committee.
I'm honored today to be here as Governor Reynolds' appointee to the Department of Revenue. I've been on the job just over 2 weeks.
Paulson is the second person to be appointed to the Director for the Department of Revenue this year. In January, Adam Humes was appointed, but after 6 weeks on the job as Director, he resigned. The previous director had left in December after being there for 7 years. In 2016, tax revenues fell below projections, causing the legislature to deappropriate around $250 million during the 2017 session. In 2017, refunds for tax returns were delayed because Iowa's cash balance was lower than usual, a fact disclosed to the public in a Des Moines Register story. Since 2017, there have been long waits for people calling the department for help. As Craig Paulson speaks to the committee, he says he is aware of these problems. As to long waits for people asking questions about their taxes, the department is adding staff to deal with the high volume of questions typical for this time of year.
We do some of that through cross-training. We do some of that through temporary employees. And so we have decreased the wait times in February and March. We're still not at a number that we like. Our goal is to answer the calls in no more than 15 minutes. And there are days we clearly don't hit that mark. It's not a simple issue to solve, but I believe it is solvable. For one thing, technology can help. We recently, and by that I mean 2 weeks ago, initiated a chatbot, which maybe you've seen. I know a lot of retailers use these, and you can actually have a chat conversation over the internet and get immediate answers. Most of those answers are driven out of commonly asked questions, and then the computer automatically generates the response, oftentimes being able to direct them to the web page that is most relevant.
Paulson says the department is also redesigning the website with customers in mind instead of acting as a series of internal documents.
I think that you, when you were in a leadership post, many times we would ask the department for projections on different tax issues.
Democratic Senator Pam Yoakum, who was the president of the Senate until 2017, asks Director Paulson about varying estimates the Department of Revenue often gives a legislator.
Sometimes we would hear that it was going to cost, the projection was $25 million, and then a year later it was closer to $100 million. And obviously that's hard for the legislature then to make good informed decisions on tax policy and budgeting. What do you see in the future of the department for your computer systems and to be able to provide us with more accurate projections and research that we need done?
We have 8 larger systems. We have also some other smaller systems, but 8 large systems to process all the different taxes and just the different processes we have to go through. Oftentimes it's difficult to get them to talk to one another. In fact, sometimes we have to have programs written to convert however the data is stored into another system so that it can talk to whatever system you need it to talk to. And I am not an IT expert, right? So I'm learning a few of these pieces. That makes the whole process more lethargic. So if y'all ask for a question on something, we may have it in this system, but we've got to get it into this other system to get you a response, and all that, like I say, just makes it more lethargic and sometimes harder to reach in and get that information out. I think it helps with that. I think we can also bring some other systems that we're still doing paper with online with those. And so that would also increase, I think, that speed. And also, I think we can have a higher confidence level of the data. I mean, there's just, I think, less opportunity for mistakes.
Paulson, like all of the governor's appointees, can only keep his job if the full Senate confirms him with at least a 2/3 vote. One of the reasons he is at this committee is to answer questions and get to know senators. During a Senate Education Committee, 3 appointees to the Iowa Board of Regents do the same thing.
Frederick Lindenmeyer, that's my real first name, but I go by Jim.
Lindenmeyer was appointed last summer.
I'm Mel Dakovich.
Dakovich has been on the board since 2013. He's being reappointed, which also requires Senate confirmation.
My name is David Barker.
And David Barker was appointed earlier this month. There are 9 members on the Iowa Board of Regents. They represent 5 educational institutions, the 3 state universities, the Iowa School for the Deaf, and Iowa Braille and Sight Saving School. It's a 6-year term, and each person applies to be selected by the governor. The board is to be as gender and politically balanced as it can be with an odd number. Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach asks about academic tenure.
We had some brief consideration of a bill here this year that would have prohibited academic tenure. That bill fortunately did not move forward. But I'd like to hear your view of the role of academic tenure in the life of the university.
David Barker responds.
I think it's an important part of academic freedom and promoting researchers pursuing the research that they want to pursue.
Jim Lindenmeyer says academic tenure is a staple of higher education.
The criticisms that I've heard about tenure revolve around the term lifetime employment, and that's not really what it is. It's really employment protection so that they cannot be terminated for just cause. So I think it's important that we have good scrutiny in the evaluation process post-tenure. But if you read tenure, as I read tenure, it's really no different than the continuing contract law in Iowa that deals with every teacher that we have in the state of Iowa.
Democratic Senator Zach Walls asks the 3 about how the universities will approach speech on campus as it relates to student groups.
I'm sure that you're familiar with the recent controversy at the University of Iowa concerning the Business Leaders in Christ organization.
The Business Leaders in Christ denied one of their members the position of vice president in 2016 because he was gay. The group said his sexuality didn't uphold their statement of faith. The university revoked the group's status. The Business Leaders in Christ sued. Last month, a judge from a U.S. District Court in Iowa ruled the university can't reject the status of this group.
I think that we probably all agree that we don't want to allow discrimination against people on campus because of their sexual orientation or gender identity or any other protected status. And so I was just hoping that each of you could walk me through briefly, how do you think about this tension between protecting the freedom of assembly and the freedom of speech for members of university student groups and the importance of protecting people who come from minority groups that both historically and today experience discrimination?
David Barker says this situation is a classic tension between different rights.
You know, there have been some court rulings on cases like this that, of course, we will need to explore how to follow correctly. And I think it's something that we will need to manage very carefully over time, because both of those, as you say, both of those rights are very important, and we don't want to trample on either of them.
Jim Lindenmeyer says free speech is a basic tenet of higher education.
I hate to say this, but I think I'm old enough now. I've lived through this once before. I was a student in the late 60s and 70s, and it seemed, and I can remember. It seems like there were protests about everything in those days, and some of them were violent. And some of you in this room are old enough to remember there were students killed at Kent State University on that campus. And so this isn't the first time historically we've lived through this. Where I think the key is not limiting free speech, but it's managing the behavior that comes along with that, and that's the challenge for administrators and people who run campuses and run those events. And unfortunately, we're in a time right now where sometimes that gets out of hand. I'm hoping that we'll evolve out of that again as we did earlier. But free speech itself, I don't think, should be threatened.
Milt Dakovich says these situations need to be considered on an individual basis.
All of them are slightly different, I agree. It's a struggle. It's a problem. It needs to be dealt with.
That afternoon, the Senate debates a solution to these kind of conflicts. Floor manager for the bill is Republican Senator Amy Sinclair.
Senate File 274 is an act relating to speech and expression at public institutions of higher education. This includes our Regent universities and community colleges.
The bill has five sections, one about definitions, another about policy adoption, protected activities, forums on campus, and remedies. Senator Zach Walz offers an amendment that would modify part of the third section. It states a university can't deny benefits to an organization if it requires leadership in that organization to agree to its established beliefs. Those include beliefs protected by the First Amendment, like religion.
My concern simply is that this subsection is going to prevent this chamber from doing what I think we should do, which is supporting a unanimous bipartisan bill that says the Iowa Senate strongly believes unanimously in the importance of the freedom of speech. And I believe that this subsection will unfortunately prevent many of us from supporting the rest of the bill, because this subsection will, and I don't necessarily believe intentionally, but I believe it will create a loophole that will lead to discrimination against students at our state schools who are from a group that is either historically or even contemporaneously marginalized.
But the bill's floor manager, Senator Sinclair, argues against Senator Walz's amendment.
The question is whether universities can single out belief-based groups they disagree with by denying them the same support and freedoms they've offered to everyone else. Any direct monetary support comes not from the university, but comes from student activity fees that the students themselves are paying. Courts and the universities have always been clear that there is no state endorsement tied to any student group having access to such money. All kinds of clubs organize around beliefs that some students share and other students oppose. Religious students pay these fees too. And of course, they understand that their money, the money that they pay, may also go to clubs with which they disagree. What makes this fair is the ability of religious students to organize their own clubs on an equal basis as everyone else. As a matter of practical necessity, this must include the right to have leaders who support the goals of the club's mission.
Senator Walz says his amendment isn't trying to change what any student organization's beliefs are.
Nobody is trying to stop students from professing what they believe. We are trying to make sure that all students are treated the same.
The amendment is voted down on party lines. Senator Herman Kornbach says, aside from this section, he likes the rest of the bill.
I supported Senator Walz's amendment because I think it would have made it a perfect bill, but perfection is hard to come by in this chamber, as I think we all recognize.
There isn't much debate on this bill. During Senator Sinclair's closing remarks, she says this bill protects the free assembly rights of students. She focuses on groups centered on religion.
This bill provides common sense, proactive protections and safeguards for the belief-based student organizations in Iowa. Not passing this bill threatens students at all of Iowa's public universities and community colleges by taking away the ability of students and other members of campus to exercise the rights that are promised them in the First Amendment. What this bill does not do is deny any student membership to a student organization they wish to join. We want to allow students the ability to participate in whatever activities and groups that they wish to without the threat of any discrimination. But it is also not our place to tell a Christian group, a Muslim group, an LGBTQ group, or any other belief-based organization that they must be led by people who do not affirm the very beliefs on which the group was founded. It is also not the role of our universities to filter controversial, disagreeable, unwelcome, or even potentially offensive ideas. The university needs to be neutral and allow students and faculty to have the freedom to discuss any topic covered by the First Amendment.
The bill passes with all Republicans as well as five Democrats voting for it. That includes Senator Kornbach. A few days later, the bill also passes in the House of Representatives. It can now be considered by the governor. If the governor signs the bill, the law will go into effect the day she signs it. This is the weekly legislative podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble.
Children are not supposed to die. It's a tough on the parents. It's traumatic for the caregivers. But that end-of-life care for children is something that parents must handle.
Republican Representative Ashley Hinson floor manages a bill that limits a court from removing life support from a minor if there are objections from a parent or guardian.
So that means unless there is conclusive medical evidence that the child would be dead without mechanical or artificial means keeping a vital function of life going, their breathing or their heart, it is up to the parents or the guardians to make that call.
The bill is short. It's 12 lines long, but the discussion in the House extends for 2 hours. Democratic Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel offers an amendment that rewrites those lines. Wessel-Crichel says her amendment considers what to do if no parent or guardian is available or willing to make this decision to remove their child from life support.
I found language that comes from the American Medical Association Journal, the Ethics Journal. And that's where my amendment comes from. My amendment states that the courts do not, just as the bill does, have the authority to withdraw life support unless there are some very specific situations, such as the parents disagree, or is there is not a parent willing to make the decision. I prefer that parents make these decisions no matter how hard it is for them. However, we have an excellent third branch of government who I believe is there to step in when we have conflict.
Representative Hinson says she appreciates the research for this amendment, but
I think that in essence we'd be creating death panels by allowing these things to happen. I appreciate that hospitals have process for this, but I also believe while the courts do have a role in this, they should be appointing a guardian. There are emergency procedures to have that that process play out in the courts, but that guardian should be the one to make that decision.
The amendment fails. As the discussion on the bill resumes, much of the conflict centers around what to do if one parent disagrees with the other as to what to do.
There's no emergency valve exit on this thing.
Democratic Representative Brian Meyer.
If there is a disagreement with the parents that, when you take away the ability of a judge in equity or law to come in and step into those very heart-wrenching decisions, I think it becomes very clear that there is no outlet. There is no plan B. There's essentially no way to have anybody make a decision based on what I'm looking at, unless the child is, in fact, brain dead by definition.
Democratic Representative Mary Wolf has practiced family law as an attorney. Wolf says when parents disagree, especially during a separation or divorce, some put their child in the middle of their conflict.
If there was a situation where a child was on life support and perhaps the doctors came and said, you know, this is over, and I'll say the dad says, okay, I understand that, it's time. And the mom, who maybe doesn't like the dad's new girlfriend or thinks the dad just wants to get out of paying the bills or whatever, the mom says, no, I'm not going to go along with this.
Wolf says in this hypothetical scenario, a judge would be prohibited from making any ruling. She says the bill's language focuses on a parent, not parents.
So our judges, I think these days, are extremely careful to try and obey the letter of the law so as to avoid being labeled activist judges. So I think the judge would say, well, it says I can't issue this order over the objection of a child's parent. So if one or both parents object, I can't do it.
Representative Hinson says under existing family law, any parent or guardian who disagrees can go to the court to have this settled.
The procedures are already in place in our code for that to happen. What this line 4 says, a court of law or equity shall not have the authority to require the withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures. A court cannot order that. A court can decide which guardian makes that decision or which parent makes that decision in cases of conflict, but the court is not the one taking away that life. The parents have to make that terrible terrible choice.
Hinson says the court can choose which parent to listen to.
In these matters, they could determine which parent, for instance, as we've described tonight several times, in challenges to cases where they might have to make a decision on removing that life support, the court could decide then who would be the guardian or who would be the one to make that decision.
Democratic Representative Mark Smith opposes this bill and says it should be reworked.
This is a terrible piece of legislation. It is too bad that we are debating it tonight when we're close on the philosophical issues and could have drafted a bill that would have had all of the representatives or the majority, vast majority of the representatives supporting it.
Republican Representative John Jacobson says those opposing this bill take away the rights of parents to choose for their child.
If we were to do what the opposites want to do tonight versus what we are suggesting, by taking away parental authority for even life-sustaining treatment, meaning breathing and food and water, if we take that right away from parents, we're going way beyond where New York is in Vermont. We're moving from infanticide to pedicide, and it's damnable and it's despicable.
Representative Jacobson is comparing recent abortion bills in New York and Vermont that have been criticized by abortion rights opponents as infanticide. As Representative Hinson makes her closing remarks, she says this is a simple bill about life.
It's about the hope of life, it's about the challenges of life, and it's about the heartbreak of life and that decision you have to make. Public bodies, very simply, should not have the ability to take away that right of parents and guardian to make those tough decisions. Those decisions are the best for the family when they're made close to the family. This bill is about giving children every fighting chance they can, and parents want to have that option and that right, and it should not be left up to the courts. That's all this bill does. It simplifies that.
The bill passes with all Republicans voting for. They are joined by 7 Democrats. It now awaits a discussion in the Senate. This is the weekly legislative podcast Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble.
Four Supreme Court judges under our present system can change the Constitution according to the way they think it should be and the way they think it has evolved, and the rest of us have no real way to counteract that.
Republican Senator Julian Garrett is often critical of Iowa Supreme Court rulings. There are 7 justices. Last year, Garrett proposed that when a Supreme Court ruling says a state law is unconstitutional, such action should require 5 justices and not 4. That bill did not become law.
I want to change the system. I think we have a better chance of getting judges who will follow the Constitution than under the present system, which just hasn't worked over the years.
This year, Garrett is proposing changing how a person is considered to be a justice. He says one of his reasons to change the court stems from a Supreme Court ruling last year,
where they declared a 72-hour waiting period for abortions to be unconstitutional. There's nothing whatever in our state constitution or the federal constitution, for that matter, about abortions. This is something that courts have just made up and have told us that, well, surprise, after all this time, we now see that our constitutions contain a right to an abortion. And anybody can read the Constitution, they won't find a thing talking about abortion.
Democratic Senator Rob Hogue says Iowa has a retention system where justices can be removed on election day by the voting public.
The author of the opinion that Senator Garrett was quoting from was retained with over 65% of the vote. All of the judges currently on the court have stood for retention, have been retained, with the exception of the most recent appointees from Governor Branstad and Governor Reynolds.
Senator Garrett says one of the problems with our present system is that justices are selected by a nominating commission that doesn't have enough accountability. Here is how it works right now. The State Judicial Nominating Commission has 17 members. This body selects people to be considered for the High Court as well as appeals courts. 8 of these commissioners are selected by the governor. 8 are chosen by members of the Iowa Bar Association. The nominating commission is chaired by a senior member of the Iowa Supreme Court. This commission chooses potential justices who are then forwarded to the governor, who makes the final decision as to who will be on the Iowa Supreme Court. Senator Garrett's proposal would allow 8 members of this nominating commission to be selected by leaders of the House and Senate instead of members of the Iowa Bar Association. This week, it comes to the Senate for a full debate. Senator Garrett floor manages the bill. He says right now members of the State Judicial Nominating Commission are not from smaller Iowa towns.
7 of the 8 members that are elected by attorneys are from bigger cities around the state. 1 is from Fort Dodge. That's not exactly a small town, but it's not as big as the others. So the result has been the commission, the attorney elected members are dominated by the bigger cities. If you're from a small town, obviously you don't have much chance of getting on the commission.
The bill allows the Speaker of the House, House Minority Leader, Senate Majority Leader, and Senate Minority Leader each to appoint 2 members to the State Judicial Nominating Commission. Senator Rob Hoge offers an amendment stating those nominated by the governor and legislative leaders should be subject to Senate confirmation. Right now, only those from the governor are required to have Senate confirmation.
This bill would put the commission appointment process behind closed doors, without public input, and in the hands of 5 people who happen to be in highly partisan positions without any review by anybody. So, there are practical problems with that, which is why Amendment 3025 is in front of us, because if you have Senate confirmation, you take the selection process for the commission out from behind closed doors, and you put it in front of this body where everybody gets to scrutinize the people who have been appointed, and senators get to vote on whether that person meets the basic qualifications for the job.
Minority Leader Janet Peterson supports the amendment requiring Senate confirmation and says it's about checks and balances.
As someone who would be in charge of nominating persons under this legislation, if it does go through, I would welcome the opportunity to have the secondary review by this body, as we do for all of the governor's appointees. I don't believe we should go changing the system that is not broken.
The amendment to include Senate confirmation is defeated on party lines. The heart of this debate is not having members from the Iowa Bar Association elect 8 commissioners. This process was created in 1962 as a constitutional amendment. It does state legislative action could be added in the future to alter the process. But Senator Hoge argues the changes the legislature is proposing go beyond this. He questions the constitutionality of these changes.
This is just a naked Republican short-term power grab. That's what this is. You are so full of yourselves, sitting here at 32 members and the majority in the House and Governor Reynolds, the trifecta back, that you say, we don't have to follow the Constitution.
There is a lot to this bill, but it is mainly focused on the state commission concerning the Supreme Court. But it also makes some changes to how the commissions for 14 district courts work. The district commissions select potential justices for their region of the state. This proposed change still allows members of the State Bar Association to select their half of a district court commission, with the other from the governor. But it changes how each district commission is chaired. Presently, a chair is whoever is the district court judge in that area. Republican Senator Dan Dawson says the bill allows district court commissions to select their own chair, removing an undue influence of the senior judge.
This bill before us removes that senior judge out there, who, by the way, all the lawyers will go before that judge at some point in time in court. There is an inherent conflict right there. This bill removes that senior judge and allows the commission themselves to select their chair.
There are arguments from the Democrats about why Republicans want to change how justices make their way to the bench. Democratic Senator Joe Bolcom accuses Republicans of reacting to controversial social issues.
You folks still don't like the fact that gay people who love each other and want to spend their lives together can get married. You still can't believe that happened.
The 2009 Iowa Supreme Court decision paved the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa. Because this bill will allow the governor and legislative leaders to appoint state nominating commissioners, Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach says it allows whoever is in charge at the time to have too much power.
Your party, my friends, will not hold the majority forever. A day of reckoning will come. Think about the politicians / judges that some Democrats will wish to appoint. If the travesty of this bill becomes law, you will rue the day that you ever voted for it. Please, please, please honor your oath of office. Protect our system, protect the Constitution, protect the independence of the Iowa judiciary. Vote no on this bill.
The idea for this bill has been around for several weeks, and not all Republicans supporting it say it is about judicial activism or recent court decisions. Floor manager Senator Garrett, however, reiterates his objection to Supreme Court decisions about abortion. During his closing remarks, he says he's wanted to change the courts long before that, since he arrived in office in 2011. Garrett says now is the tipping point when a change can be made.
We need to pass the bill, send it over to the House, and hopefully we can get it passed there and let the governor sign it. She's made it pretty clear she's in favor of what we're doing here. So I just ask your support. Let's go back to the time when we had judges that were not legislating from the bench. I know we've had that term made fun of here today, but that's exactly what the problem is. So please vote for the bill. Thank you very much.
The bill passes on a party line vote. Governor Reynolds issues a statement saying, while the current process was created with good intentions, it's now filled with backroom politics that leave the vast majority of Iowans in the dark. The bill is awaiting debate in the House of Representatives. This is the Legislative Podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. This week, a subcommittee advanced a proposal about property taxes. It would cap tax revenue growth at 2% a year. Cities and counties can raise it if voters call for a referendum. County and city associations worry this limitation could impede their ability to provide services, especially in areas that are growing quickly. They also worry a cap on funds carried over into the next budget year would lead to cash flow problems. It's been a busy week in both the Senate and House chambers, and we have more stories about the bill's passing from our State House reporter, Katarina Sestarik. You can read her work at iowapublicradio.org. Her stories are also of great help to this show. We're also getting help from the press pool at the Capitol, Aaron Murphy, Barbara Rodriguez, Kay Henderson, Caroline Cummings, David Pitt, James Lynch, and Stephen Gruber-Miller are often right next to me at the Capitol providing insights and feedback through the many legislative movements. Also help from our talk show team, producers Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, Lindsay Moon, and host Ben Kiefer contributed to today's show. Iowa Public Radio News Director Michael Leland is always in the mix and provides script editing with his red pen. We release a new episode of Under the Golden Dome on Fridays from podcast providers like iTunes, Google Play. The show is always published at iowapublicradio.org, where you can grab a link of, say, today's show and spread it all over Twitter, Facebook, send it as an email to your parents, or show them how to listen to the show with that phone or iPad you gave them for the holidays or their birthday. It's worth it. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.